Okay, good morning. I think two introductions are necessary in order to discuss Midrash in any way. The first is just, what is Midrash? When was Midrash written? So on the top of the very first page, there's a timeline. So we're talking about a huge work of exegetical, that means explaining, roughly speaking, that means explaining, and homiletical, that means kind of lessons or hashkafa, so to speak. Starting in, this is the Second Temple era, right, or after the destruction of the Second Temple, really, from the Tannaitic time, that's the authors of the Mishnah, until, you know, really late, like the Shemot Rabbah, Bamidbar Rabbah was written in the 1100s, and even today there are works of Midrashim that are still being compiled and kind of written. So whenever you open up a book that's Midrash, whether it's Yalkut Shmoni, whether it's Ein Yaakov, whether it's a Sifra, you always have to question, you know, the specific Midrash that you're looking at might be written at an earlier time than the book was actually put together. So that's why it's kind of hard to pin down, you know, when was this Midrash written. So for convenience sake, I'm going to avoid that question, you know, throughout the topic of this year when we bring up, you know, specific Midrashim. We're just going to kind of view them more as a methodology and not really from a historical lens. So that's just one. And the second introduction that I want to do is, you know, I feel like Midrash has so many great stories. It's a story. Okay, so this is a story, I don't know if it's true, about Nechama Leibowitz. That one time she was asked to give a class to a group of soldiers. So she walks into the classroom, introduces herself, you know, passes out some Tanachim, much like I passed out the source sheets. And she says, okay, everybody, please turn to the story in Bereishit of Avram breaking the idols. So all the soldiers get busy and they start, you know, flipping through. And one by one, they start, oh God, did you find it? Right? Did you find it, right? And then finally, right, this is very laughing, right, because that is a Midrash. It is not actually written in Tanakh. But it's such a powerful story, and it's one that's so ingrained in us of, you know, the little boy Avraham going around breaking his father's idols and, you know, facing up, you know, coming up to his monotheism and, you know, confronting his father about their pagan ways. And finally, one soldier slams the Tanakh down in frustration. He says, I don't understand. You have a different Tanakh. Because the Tanakh I had when I was a kid had this story. So where is the where is that Tanakh? Right, it's a different one. Right, so I feel like that, to me, illustrates the importance of coming up with a Derech HaLimud or a methodology for how to approach Midrash. So I picked four techniques from my most favorite Midrashim in Tanakh, each of which illustrates, I think, a different technique that the authors of the Midrash used, and it kind of also describes their goals and what they were trying to accomplish by writing Midrash. Because I can give you the Wikipedia definition of Midrash, which I looked up this morning in preparation for this class, right? Because that's a very important... Sorry. Okay. In preparation for this class, but that I think showing you is so much better than telling you. Okay. So the first, I think, technique that everybody knows, it's just kind of like, until you put a name to it, you might not necessarily recognize, is something that James Kugel, the author of How to Read the Bible and other, you know, tremendous works, calls omnisignificance. He made up this word, omnisignificance, all significant, all meaning. The way that Chazal approach every word in the Torah is that every letter, every nekudah, has meaning and has significance. And if there's an extra letter, you have to darshan it and ask why, right? And this is, I think, the number one technique that Chazal used when they approached Torah. It is no simple thing. It is no mere thing. They don't just, you know, throw their hands up in the air and say, well, you know, the Torah nechzavel b'shom b'nei adam, right? As Rambam often says, right? No, every word, every letter has meaning. And my favorite example of this is with regard to their approach to the punishment that the spies get. The text that I brought you in source number one is in reaction to the sin of the spies of Chemer Glim in the previous chapter in Perek Yud Gimel. Hashem tells Bnei Yisrael what their punishment's going to be. And in these psukim, you see, it's very much falling into the lines of midah keneged midah. So the spies were in Eretz Yisrael for 40 days. Bnei Yisrael, you're going to be wandering in the desert for 40 years, right? Bnei Yisrael, you called out and said that you have no interest in fighting for this land. You have no interest in kind of, you know, conquering it. You feel like you can't. So the ones who will die are going to be the males 20, 20 and up, the ones who were supposed to be the soldiers, you're going to be the ones to die. You called and said, Hashem, our children are for sure going to die. Hashem says, no, I guarantee they will be the ones who will go into Eretz Yisrael. It's very much, right, measure for measure, right, quid pro quo. And then, right, you have to ask yourself, though, but the ones who really sinned were the spies, right? They're not, it's not really B'nai Yisrael, they just kind of, you know, complained, but it's really the spies who caused this. And in contrast to this extended speech about what's going to happen to B'nai Yisrael, if you look at Pasuk Lamed Vav, it kind of just dismisses them very quickly. In contrast to this long speech about what happened to B'nai Yisrael, it says in Pasuk Lamed Vav, V'ha'anashim asher shalach Moshe lator ta'aretz v'yishivu v'ilunu alav al kol ha'ita l'utzit diba la'aretz v'amutu anashim l'utzit diba ta'aretz v'abba magifah l'fnei Hashem. Oh, they died in a plague. Well, where's the speech? Where's the midah k'neged midah? Where's the, you know, what happened to them? And this question was, you know, fertile territory for Chazal to come up with what happened to them. So the first thing I should point out is that I read Pasuk Lamed Zayin very quickly, because this is a great example of them seeing omni-significance in Pasuk Lamed Zayin. So first of all, Motziyei Dibat Ha'aretz. Like, Lahotzi means to, like, take out, and Dibat has a very negative connotation. It means, like, a bad report. So they took out a bad report about the land. Right? They died. Ba Magefa, which means in the plague. It doesn't mean in a plague. If you wanted to say in a plague, you would say b'magefa. But if you want to say in the plague, right, with a definite article, it's b'magefa. It's like ha-magefa and the bet put together, the bet takes the nikud of the hay. B'magefa. So, and lifnei Hashem, before Hashem. So two koshim, right? First of all, what's the plague? What plague? Tell us what plague it was. Secondly, what do you mean before Hashem? Obviously, Hashem was the one who said this is all what's going to happen to them. So this is, I think, just a great Rashi that illustrates, quoted from Midrash, right, that illustrates this omni-significance. With the exact death that was designed for them, measure for measure. And then, and this is a great Midrash because it goes on to break down every piece, how it's midah k'neged midah. So the spies sin with their mouths, right? Lashon hara. So nishtar beib lashonam ad tivuram. So their tongue stretched until their belly buttons. V'toloim yotze milshonam. And then like little creepy crawlers, you want to say worms, right? Crawled out of their tongues. Uba'in latoch tivuram. And my stomach is bigger these days, right? Crawled into their stomach. L'kach ne'emar ba magefa v'lo b'magefa. And that's why it says in the plague and not in a plague. Okay, so thanks very much, Chazal, for writing a great cartoon, basically. Right? What do you mean you're coming up with such a bizarre death? I get the tongue is midah k'neged midah, but like, what do you mean you're just... First of all, it doesn't say this anywhere in the text. What does Chazal the right to like come up with this bizarre kind of death, right? So what I would say is, this is omni-significance. This is not, you know, making up creative fairy tales about how they died. This is, every piece of this death, an exact, clear reading of the text. So let's go back now and read it more carefully. Ad tivuram. It's very interesting the death involves tongues and bellies eating, right? Anyone remember what the spies said about Eretz Yisrael? It eats its inhabitants, right? Eretz Yisrael is a land that eats its inhabitants. So of course Chazal would say, what do you mean? B'nai Yisrael got punished midah k'neged midah? The spies got punished midah k'neged midah exactly the same way. So they said Eretz Yisrael eats its inhabitants. You, in a sense, your plague was you were eaten almost by yourself in a way. Tola'im yotzim l'shunam, creepy crawlers climbed out of your tongues. What did the spies say about creepy crawlers? Anyone remember that one? Yes, exactly. They said that in comparison to the giants of Eretz Yisrael, hinu kechagavim be'einenu v'cheina hinu be'einehem. We were like creepy crawlers or grasshoppers, right, in comparison. That they belittled themselves to that extent. Okay, that's what you said. That's what happens to you. And then here's where you see, I guess, Chazal's goal in this midrash. Whether or not this happened or not, do we take this literally? I don't know. But Chazal sure wanted you to take this seriously, because the lesson they wanted to emphasize in this was, I'm just reading the last line of Rashi, v'zeu lefnei Hashem. That's why the pasuk says lefnei Hashem. Ve'oteha ru'ya lahem al pi midotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because it was exactly deserve it according to the midot of Hashem, shehu moded minak negen midah. Because that is the number one attribute we need to recognize about Hashem, that He isn't just a vengeful God who just kind of casually kills people. He considers carefully exactly what you deserve, which I think is the number one complaint we have when reading Sefer Bamidbar. Do they really deserve all of these things that happen to them? Chazal's point they want to keep emphasizing is it's midah keneged midah. So in a sense, you see Chazal, by this kind of technique of omni significance, which is employed throughout, are trying to kind of recapture what they see as like the telos of Torah. In other words, you could read Torah and Tanakh and just be like, okay, I get these stories, but you're missing almost the truer essence of what's really going on. And their job, in a way, from I think this first technique, is to recapture what the text is really trying to tell you. It's like a story that, I mean, my students up front will probably have probably heard, right, so many times, is, down the hallway, you're walking down the hallway, and you hear me say to a student, I'm so mad at you, I'm going to kill you. So, like any good student, what do? You take out your phone, which, unfortunately, you have now, right? And you call 911, and you say, there's a teacher who is threatening the lives of students, right? And we need a SWAT team now, right away, because we probably have a hostage situation on our hands. But this is unfortunate because, you know, the truest sense of what I'm saying, and we shouldn't speak this way, and I do not speak this way to students, don't worry, is the truest sense is, no, I'm so mad at you, right? We speak in hyperbole. Chazal see their job is to get to the truest sense of what really the text is really saying. Okay. Technique number two, if you turn to page two, please. Chazal saw their job not just to get to like what the text is like really saying, but also in a sense to kind of deal with what do you make of the gaps in the text. So modern scholarship will talk about, you know, multiple authorship, and that's why there are gaps, or, you know, faulty editors, and, you know, things like that. But when this is a problem, like a real significant problem, because when you think about Torah as written by, you know, the all-perfect divine, right, it has to be perfect. So then how could there be gaps? Why is there missing information? And then what is missing, right? So a great gap, not a great gap, but I think one of the most powerful, significant gaps is the prelude to Akedah Yitzchak in Sefer Bereishit. Look at source number 3. Vahi achar dvarim ha'ela velokim nisat Avraham. And with that opening, right, the Akedah just kind of starts. And it's like this powerful, huge narrative. But the way that Torah frames it is, it was after these matters, or dvarim in Biblical Hebrew, probably words. So, well, if this is a huge, significant story, the Torah gives us a context. We want to know what's the context, but we don't know. So, of course, you turn to the previous chapter, Parak Chaf Aleph, and you see in Parak Chaf Aleph, there are two narratives. There's the narrative of the birth of Yitzchak and the struggles that ensue with Yishmael, and then the banishment of Yishmael. And then there's the brit that Avram makes with Avimelech in order to secure his rights to kind of live comfortably in the land of the Plishtim. So Rashbam talks about, you know, maybe the Akedah in a sense is a punishment for Avram making this brit with Avimelech. But the Midrash Rabbah quotes three examples or three suggestions for what Dvarim is referring to, after what matters. This is Chazal filling in the gap, telling you, we want to know what. It's important to know what. Let's tell you what. Okay, so Aleph. Okay. Achar hirhurei dvarim. After murmurings. After kind of thoughts. More like kind of maybe self-doubt in a way. Shehayusham. Mi hirher. Who was doubting or murmuring? Avram hirher. Avram was kind of, after the birth of Yitzchak, he was in this state of self-doubt and insecurity. Amar samachti v'samachti et hakol. I threw this big party because I'm so happy that Yitzchak was finally born, and I made everybody else happy too. V'lo hefrashti l'Kadosh Baruch Hu lo parachad v'lo ayalachad. But I guess I forgot to give a korban to Hashem. He's basically in this state of self-doubt of, did I do enough to show my gratitude to Hashem for the birth of Yitzchak? I threw this grand party celebrating that it's, you know, me and Sarah, our simcha, was I grateful enough to Hashem? And so, Amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu, Amanat Shana Amar lach, Tzekrivei Pincha v'lo Takev. Hashem's like, I got it, I'll give you an opportunity to do this. You read this midrash, and you're like, Well, maybe he, I don't know, shouldn't have said that, because I would have almost preferred to live in that insecurity instead of, you know, being told to have the akedah. But I guess when you think about it like this, so what lesson are Chazal trying to tell you? They're trying to say, in a way, Avram, as the protagonist of the akedah, wanted it, right? And that puts a totally different spin on how you view the akedah, right? And it's not that he wanted it, but that he saw it as an expression of proving his devotion, in a sense, to Hashem, which puts a different spin on how you see the akedah story just by that kind of commentary. Yes.
Avram would have thought of it, so he could have gone and did a carbon right.
Exactly. Why didn't he just bring a carbon? Exactly. Exactly. Right. Okay, so take a look at Bet. Very similar, but almost like a different version. Okay? Va'alde te de Rabbi Eliezer de Amar Elokim, Velokim hu ubeitino malche asharit amru. No, who were their hehurim? It wasn't Avram's hehurim or Dvarim. It was the celestial court. It was Hashem sitting there with Beit Dino, his posse, so to speak. And they said, Avram Zeh, hey, check out Avraham. Samach v'simech et hakol. He made this big party upon the birth of Yitzchak. V'lo hefrish l'kadosh baruch hu lo paracha v'lo ayachad. But Hashem, did you notice that he forgot to give you a present? He didn't bring you any korbanot. Amar l'kadosh baruch hu, Hashem says, hey, don't speak about Avraham that way. Hashem's like, just watch. I bet if I ask Avraham to bring me a par, right, he would to bring me more than a par, bring me his son as a korban, he would do it. And then the akedah ensues. Now with this version of the midrash, the akedah then is a test that Hashem designs to prove to everybody else how incredible Avram's devotion is. That Hashem, in a way, sees it as, of course, Avram's going to pass, and of course, we know Avram is at that level, we just need to prove it to everybody else, so that your doubts about Avraham are kind of assuaged. Very different spin on it. Well, skip Gimel, just in the interest of time, you can read it, it's a different version. I'm just interested in the different versions suggested by Aleph and Bet about this of, like, Hashem expecting a korban, or doubting about whether you deserve a korban, giving enough gratitude to Hashem. So Chazal are obviously trying to fill in a gap, but there's also another technique employed here, which is dialogue. When Chazal fill in missing information, right, their perspective on Torah is obviously closed canon, that everything we have in the Torah is complete, right? It's not like there are other versions of stories that are out there, right, that are somehow should be in there, right? It's a closed canon. So Chazal say, okay, if you want to find out what's missing in Tanakh, where should you look? Tanakh itself. Not only that, they saw stories in Tanakh as providing contrast and complementing in a way other stories. So take a look and think about the Midrash in Bet, source number 4, Bet. That Hashem is sitting there with his celestial kind of court, debating the merits of an individual, and deciding as a result to test an individual. Yeah?
This reminds me of Job. And it's,
exactly.
It's,
yeah.
It was creepy in Job, and it's creepy here.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, nothing better to do than, it's too Greek goddess, you know, these
yeah.
Really high things.
Yeah, the gods playing with man, right? Man as their plaything, man as their entertainment, so to speak. And that's why I brought source number 5, Eof Perek Aleph, right, from Job, where Chazal, assuming you know all, they assume obviously you read Tanakh all the time and you know it by heart, that you, when you read this midrash, they don't mean you to read it in a vacuum. They mean for you to read this midrash and think about Eof. They plagiarized, I'm not saying in a negative sense, they purposely did this. They took Eof, Perek Aleph, and rewrote it as a midrash about Avraham. Except instead, and you can, if your memory of Eof isn't so clear, right? Look at Eof, Perek Aleph, right? They're all standing around. Eof is this great guy, it seems. And even the suspicion that his children aren't perfection, that's why he brings korbanot every night, right? Unlike Avraham, who I guess was a little lax. And when the Satan is going around, Hashem's like, have you seen my guy Eof? Isn't he just the best? And the Satan's like, well, you know, Eof has a great life. You did everything for him. So of course he's good. It's easy to be good if your life is good, right? So Hashem's like, just watch, right? Let's make Yehov suffer and see how he stands up to it. Chazal, in this sense, though, they see are putting Eov and Avram side by side, and they're saying, let's consider the following scenario. Hashem gives you everything. Eov, Avraham. Hashem makes you suffer. And then you have to ask yourself, what is your personal point of breakage? So each of us has to consider this, or each of us might have already experienced this tragically in life. At what point in your life does it get bad enough for you to just break down? Is it loss of a loved one, right? Is it finances? What is it? Is it stress at work? Everyone has our breaking point. And Chazal look at Eov and Avram and they say, interesting. For Eov, it's when the Satan thinks about what he needs to test him, it has to take away everything. He has to boils and finances and all of his children and, you know, isolation from his from society because he's a leper in a way, right? Everything. For Avram, it was one thing. His breaking point was Yitzchak. It was that, it wasn't money, it wasn't anything, it was just Yitzchak. That's it. That's Yitzchak for Avraham was everything else for Eov. And they're kind of like forcing you to see Avram and Eov side by side and compare them, which isn't fair, right? To compare suffering, to compare tests by God. And then another thing is that they're forcing you to consider the fact that Eov, say for Eov is so long because Eov does an awful lot of talking, an awful lot of complaining and questioning. And Elohim said to Avraham, Avram says nothing, right? He doesn't say anything. And that points out, I think, in a sense, the greatness and the heroism and also makes the Akedah story even creepy and, tragic, right, because of that. So Chazal, by writing the magician that they do, are forcing you to kind of compare, even, you know, unconsciously, because they're not citing their sources, right, to compare others. So I think the best tool for when you're reading Midrash is Tanakh in a way, right? It's to think about what other stories could they be referencing when you read Midrashim. Okay. The fourth technique that I chose is something that I like to call conservation of biblical personality. And it's when, and this I think is one of the most familiar techniques because you just see it all over. This is when Chazal say, these two people, they're the same person, right? And we kind of grew up, knowing obviously Shifra and Pur, Yocheved and Miriam. And really, I'm almost embarrassed to say how old I was before I considered the question, which is, first of all, why would Chazal say that? What gives them the right? And then secondly, like, okay, if Yocheved and Miriam are Shifra and Pua, why don't Shifra and Pua just get called Yocheved and Miriam, right? Like, why do they have two different names, right? And then it kind of, like, gets even more Kabbalistic of, like, you know, Yonah ben Amittai, right, is the son that Eliyahu saved and is a Gilgal of other people, right, and Pinchas and Eliyahu, and it kind of, like, spans different time periods. And it gets really interesting when they start talking about, you know, Bilam and Eov and like just like people who are like you almost forget that like there's a timeline in Tanakh, right? And like hundreds of years apart, it's all the same person. So I want to consider one example. The most famous example is the Miel Docha from Point of Chavad Miriam, and just suggest humbly, I think, one way of viewing it. So if you look at line 2, who, I think in this context, who were the mialdot? Who were these midwives? Rav Amar, Kala v'chamata. It was a mom and a daughter-in-law. Yocheved ve'elisheva bat Aminadav, who was identified as Aaron's wife. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman Amar, Isha ve'bita. No, it was a woman and her daughter. Yocheved v'Miriam, and that's the more famous one, because Rashi quotes it, obviously, so that's the one that's kind of became more famous. Okay, and then it goes on to kind of give you some logic and math for that. Okay, so if, Chazal were so certain that it was really Yocheved and Miriam, right, there wouldn't be other opinions, right? The fact, I think that's interesting, which is often it's unfortunate we look at the Rashi version quoted. We don't look at the Midrash. Because in Midrash, you see there are different versions suggested, and there's almost like they try to prove to each other, well, why should I believe this? Right? There's a logic. There's a pill to it. So what are they trying to do? So I want to suggest is that you got to look at the first line of a midrash, the line that I kind of hastily skipped over. Because in our rush for content, we kind of sometimes forget to contextualize midrash. So the midrash starts with, Kishara'a shehim parim rabim b'gazar al hazcharim. When they saw that they had, you know, what Paro had, what had done and done against the males. The story of Shemot, of Perek Aleph and Perek Bet, is a story of individuals looking at injustice. And when you think about the stories that we have and the stories that we don't have, it's individuals being willing to stand up to injustice. And the way Chazal looked at it is they said, okay, who was willing to stand up? So when that decree came, which everybody saw is genocidal, right? We're going to kill male Jewish babies, right? Forget making them work hard. Forget taking away the straw. We're outright going to kill them. Who was willing to stand up to this major form of injustice? Paro's daughter, right, Batya, the Mialdot, and Yochaved and Miriam, right? In the sense that they saved their son, right? So they condensed these figures, and they said that's conservation of biblical personality. You have two Mialdot, and you have a mother and daughter willing to stand up to injustice. They're the same. They might not be the same person. I don't know if they're the same person. In fact, I think, honestly, the story reads better if the Mialdot are Egyptian, but they have the same essence. People willing to stand up to injustice. And I think that, I think, is a technique I think we have to approach conservation of biblical personality throughout Tanakh in general when Chazal do it, which is, do we know if they're the same person? I don't know. Does it make sense? Sometimes yes, sometimes it really doesn't, right? But it's the essence of the person that's the same, and that is just as significant a lesson. And then I would say, number seven, that enables us to move beyond, I guess, the notion that we have of Chazal from when we're little, right? So when you're little, right, I love the little midrash says. My parents, I loved it so much when I was like 7 or 8. My parents got me the whole set as a present. And I was like excited about it. Like I, right? And I really read it cover to cover. Like it was like my favorite, one of my favorite things to read. And now I look at myself and I laugh at myself because like I ate it up. It was so exciting. It was like reading the Babysitter's Club books. It was just, it had everything, right? It had drama, it had excitement, and I just like fell in love with it. And then like I got into high school and my love affair with the Little Midrash says seemed to die because I was like, this is just a made up bunch of hooey, right? And that is so unfortunate because when you take everything literally, there's no room for you to find the essence and the kind of serious nature. And that is actually what Rambam warns against in source number 7. He says there are three groups of people you encounter when you consider Chazal. And he's not just talking about, you know, homiletical magician, the magician we kind of focus on. He's talking about Midrash Halakha as well, right? What do you do? Like, how do you know that phylacteries are supposed to be black and look the way they do, right? That's Midrash Halakha, right? You should know that as to the words of the sages, people are divided into three groups, right? So I'm not going to take a poll and divide you all into three groups, right? But I would say, you know, Rambam definitely was looking at his society and was saying there are three schools of thought. The first group consists of the majority of the people I've met. Those that I read their books that I've heard about, they understand them literally without explaining them at all. Accepting impossibilities as fact. You take everything Chazal say literally. If Chazal said it, it's true. Okay? They did this because of their ignorance and their distance from the sciences. They're not engaged simply in the modern world. And so they're willing to say that everything that happened that Chazal say happened. And he accuses them of not being cognizant enough of how reality works, in a way. I'm skipping a little bit. They therefore think that all the intelligent sayings of the sayings are understood literally as they understood them, although there are some sayings that are strange. Okay, that's group number one. The second group, who are also many, are those who have heard or seen the words of our sages and understood them literally. They also take it literally and thought that the sages did not mean anything beyond the literal meaning. And this is also a tragic reading of Chazal, because if your vision of Chazal is that they made up stuff and made up fairy tales about how the spies were punished, then why would you want to listen to Chazal? Why would you want to follow the halachot that they explicated if you suspect and you don't respect the manner in which they explicated these halachot? It's basically saying, why would you want to live the lifestyle that you do if you don't respect the rabbis who explicated it in the way that they did? So Rambam says, this is a desecration of Chazal in the same sense of taking everything that they say literally. And so they denigrate the sages and mock the words of the sages all the time. They think that they're wiser than the sages, their intelligence is sharper, that the sages of blessed memory are foolish, lacking wisdom, so they did not grasp things at all. Okay, so the first two groups he basically says are incorrect approaches to Chazal. The third group, which is very small, so small that it can barely be called a group, and many have accused Rambam for good reason of being an elitist, right? Are people for whom the wisdom and greatness of the sages has been proved. In other words, your belief in Chazal and in their authority and in the chain of Mesorah is stated. It's granted. It's your starting point. They truly understand that the sages of blessed memory won't speak about pointless things. They understand that their words have both a revealed and a hidden meaning, and that all that they say which is impossible, these words are parables and riddles. For this is the way of the wise to speak in parables and riddles. The third group, you're willing to acknowledge, and I think this has to be our Derech HaLimud, we're willing to acknowledge that not everything Chazal say is meant to be taken literally, and there are certain things that they write, which are parables and riddles in a way, certain things that they write, which we have to find, we have to look for the essence of them, instead of simply either saying, well, we just take it literally, or Chazal, we're crazy and made up stuff, right? Because both of those aren't exactly, good options or how to approach them. And I want to end by, I guess, putting into practice, we have, 10 more minutes, analyzing my personal favorite midrash of Tanakh, and hopefully employing these four techniques, we can do this as kind of a group, hopefully employing these four techniques that we've kind of seen in analyzing this midrash. And I picked a midrash that I'm fairly confident everybody recognizes, but I guess what I want to kind of enjoin you to do is kind of look at it with fresh eyes now, or hopefully fresh eyes if this should benefit you at all, to look at it and try to say, okay, what are they really trying to say in this midrash that you've seen a million times? Okay, so this is the midrash of Moshe as a little baby in the palace of Paro. Okay? After Moshe was saved by Bat Paro, he basically becomes her foster son. He becomes her adopted son. And not only that, he basically grows up as an Egyptian prince. Hayta bat paro minashaket umichaveket umichavevet oto kilu hu bena. And Midrash says that she loved him. She held him and kissed him and hugged him, and he was like her own son. Lo hayta motzi ota mipaltrin shel hamelech, and she never took him out of the palace. Lefishahaya yafa kol mitavim lerotot, because he was so cute. Everybody just was like dying to see him. Whoever saw him just couldn't tear themselves away, right? Imagine how it is to see your grandchildren, right? You just can't tear yourselves away from the cuteness. That's how he was. And Paro also would just hug him and kiss him. And he did the cutest thing. You know how kids just grab everything? He would grab Paro's crown right off his head and put it on his own head, right? Kids do that. They take your glasses, and they take your hat, and they take your kippahs, right? Kids do that. Kimo shati la sot lo kshe agadol. And then the midrash kind of introduces like the dum-dum-dum music in the background, like ominously, like, but he is doing this as a little chubby cute toddler, but this is reality. This is what's going to happen in the future. Okay. So what starts out as this innocent, adorable kid, you know, who Paro and his daughter just adore, the advisors wisely realize is a threat to national security, right? Hayusham yoshvim chartumei mitzarim v'amru, mitzarinanu mizeh. We're a little scared of this. Shenotal katrachav netnal rosho, shelo yezeh ka'oto she'anu omrim she'atid litol malchut mimecha. They're like, this might seem on the surface just like adorable, but the advisors are pointing out a very real threat, which is, when you have to worry about the line of succession, and you have this foster son that you're raising as your own, and you're adoring, and he's growing up super comfortable in the palace, right? The advisors are saying, it's a very real problem. How are we treating this boy? Is he allowed to take the crown right off your head and put it on his own? The advisors are basically saying, is Moshe your heir or not? So it's a very real threat. And so first of all, I think when I kind of grew up learning this midrash, I always just thought of the advisors as stupid. No, they are very smart. They're doing the responsible thing as advisors to the king. So that's first. But secondly, you have to realize two, three, how old is Moshe in this midrash? 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old? Not much more than that. So on another level, it's just so kind of superficial. And that's exactly the debate going on in the palace, right? Some of them probably dismiss it, but some of them say, no, let's kill him or let's burn him. In other words, we need to get rid of this kid. We need to dispatch this kid, because what starts as innocent, very, you know, clearly can end up as much more ominous. Okay. And then, here's where, I guess, the plot thickens. Haya Yitro Yoshev Beinehen Ve'omer Lahem Hanar Hazeh In Bo Da'at. This boy is just a kid. He doesn't have any knowledge of what he's doing. Pardon? Right? I don't know, right? Ella Bachanu Oto, right? They decided to test him. Hevulafanav Karaz Zaha V'Gachala. And so they brought in front of him a tray of gold coins and a tray of burning red hot coals. Im Yoshe Adol Zahav, Yeshbo Dad V'Hargo Oto. If he stretches out his hand to the gold, he knows exactly what he's doing. He has Dad. He's old enough to realize the power of his actions, and then we'll kill him. Im Yoshe Adol Gachala, but if he puts his hand out to the cold, in Bo Dad V'in Alev Mishpat Mavet. He just is attracted to bright, shiny objects, and we'll let him live. Miad Hevi Lefanav, and so they decided to do this test. She'lach Yedol Kacha Zahav. Moshe, even as a baby, is very smart and obviously has da'at, and he stretches out his hand toward the gold. Uba Gavriel, Gavriel is always the malach in Chazal who comes to save people. Gavriel the malach comes, dechat yado, pushes his hand over so that he touches the coals. Tafasat ha-gachalat, he grabs onto the gachalat, and it's really hot. So what does he do? Hichnis yado ma-gachal letoch piv, but it's so hot, so he burns his tongue. Mimenu naaseh kvad peh kvad lashon. And after this whole story, by the way, that's how Moshe came to be kvad peh kvad lashon. When Moshe complains, right, I stutter, I speak haltingly, this is how it happened. Okay, so great story, right? This is like an exciting story, but I guess let's start with the problem. So there's quite a few logical fallacies. Anyone see any, like, things that are just illogical about this midrash?
Well, but the fact is that he was kvad peh kvad lashon, so how did it get to that?
So this midrash is answering that question. So in that sense, Chazal are wondering...
Yeah,
exactly. So in a sense, it's answering a very clear question, which Chazal are basically saying they're answering the gap, right? They're minding the gap. They're basically saying there's a gap. How did Moshe get this way? This explicates it. This analyzes it. We also, I think you pointed out, right, how did Yitro get here? In a sense, I think that's a kind of conservation, right? That they kind of say, well, how did Yitro end up in Midian? Why would Yitro be an ally to Moshe? Maybe he was always an ally to Moshe, right? There had to have been people who supported him, you know, from his infancy. Maybe that's who Yitro was, right? He's a defender. He's somebody who is willing to stand up for logic and justice. And we even see this in Shemot later on when he's the one who suggests the judges. Yitro is just. Yitro is the one willing to say Hanar Hazeh In Bo Da'at. So that kind of fits in. Okay.
It was a test that was designed that he would lose.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird because, like, that's what's so illogical about this test. Like, when you think about the advisors, how do we know if kids are really smart or just, you know, doing things because they're attracted to them? So if he puts his hand out to the gold, okay, obviously he has that. But why couldn't you just say, well, gold is bright and shiny, right? And then also, just when you think about what happens when he actually touches the coals.
You wouldn't let him actually touch the coals. If he's reaching out towards it, you would immediately say, okay, yeah. Well, he's reaching towards the coals.
Right.
Get his hand out of the way, and that's
yeah,
it.
If Gavriel, if we're...
If it was really hot, he would have dropped it.
Exactly. Right. Or he would have burned his hand. Right? Right? Yeah. And that's, I just think, something that's so illogical. Gavriel the Malach comes to save him, right? Moshe's life is on the line, because as you said, this is an unfair test. He's going to lose either way. But Gavriel Malach to save him. Gavriel, couldn't you have prevented him from taking the coals? Yeah. Right? Putting in your mouth, right? It's almost like, well, why didn't he burn his hand? Right? Why didn't he drop it? Why isn't this the story of how Moshe is kvad yad? Right? When Hashem's like, take the matah, why doesn't Moshe say, I'm sorry, my hand is burned, you know I can't use it, right? So there's quite a few illogical things. So what I think is the answer to how to kind of try to get at what Chazal are trying to say is to view this text as a dialogue with other stories in Tanakh. So what really is the essence of this? So you got to look at this midrash with another word, which is a petechta. Petechta is a midrash that opens explicating a pasuk, but ends by explicating a different pasuk. This midrash, which pasuk is this midrash really trying to explain? Is it the pasuk it starts with, v'tiv'elu bat paro, that Moshe was raised in Paro's house, or is it Moshe's kvad peh kvad lashon? Yeah, it's the second, right? Chazal are really saying, let's talk about Moshe becoming a prophet and his own insecurities of being a prophet. When did that start? That started when he was little. So now that you kind of have that in your head, you got to think about, well, what are other stories of prophets being chosen and other insecurities? So if you look on the next page, I brought you two other famous, what we call like Nevuot HaKdasha, right? An inaugural Nevuah. It's kind of like you've seen like Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, right? When the hero is told you're a hero, right? The hero responds by saying, not me, right? No, I'm reluctant to take on this. And we see this in Navi as well. So you see this with Yeshayahu and you see this with Yirmiyahu, right? They see this incredible, we'll start with Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu sees Masa Merkava. He sees, we quote this in Kedusha, right? He sees Hashem surrounded by angels and he has no clue what this means, right? And look at Pasuk Hey. He says, oh my gosh, like I am so unfit to be seeing this and to be watching this. Like, you're picking me to be a Navi? Like, this is crazy. I can't possibly fulfill this role. But look at how Hashem responds, Pasuk Vav. Vayaf Eli Echad min Hasrafim. One of the angels of the Srafim flies over to him, Biyado Ritzba b'Melkachayim. And in his hand he's holding burning hot coals held with tongs that he took from the top of the Mizbeach. Vayaga al pi, and he touched my mouth, and he said, Hinenaga ze al svatecha v'sar v'necha v'chatatcha techupar. I touched you on your mouth, and it doesn't say anything about being burned, but I touched the coals on your mouth. Any doubt, any sin that you have that you feel might make you unfit to become a Navi, to take on this mission, is gone. Chazal are like, a Navi's insecurities, touched by coals, the malach is holding the tongue so nobody gets burned, right? That's Moshe. And look at Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu as well. Yirmiyahu is told, I'm skipping to Pasuk Hey, by Hashem, B'tarem etzarcha b'batin yazicha. Before you were born, as a baby, you were chosen to be a Navi. Right? Think about Moshe as a baby, right? B'tarem titzei merachem hekvaticha navi l'goyim netzicha. Before you were even born, you were chosen, you were marked to be a Navi. V'omar, aha, Adonai Elokim, hinei lo yadati dibur ki na'ar anochi. I can't, I'm just a little boy. V'omar shem elai, al tamar na'ar anochi ki hakol asher ha'shachach tzelech v'kol asher ha'tzavach tzedaber. And then look at Pasuk Tet. Hashem spread forth his hand and touched my mouth. Chazal look at other stories in Tanakh and they say, when a Navi is insecure, when a Navi is first chosen to be a Navi, his mouth is touched. A Navi is chosen as a baby. Chazal say, where's that story about Moshe? How come we don't have that story of Moshe being chosen as a young child and being touched on the mouth? We have when he's an adult and he's full of insecurities and he says five times, I can't do it, I'm kvad peh kvad lashon, because I'll say, no, that can't be it. There has to be another story. And so they write this, and they write this midrash. And so we have this midrash of Moshe as a baby being touched on the mouth, right? And that's how he came to be kvad peh kvad lashon. And just to end, I think, because you can look at it in two ways. You could say, okay, so Moshe became kvad peh kvad lashon. I kind of like the Yeshayahu Yirmiyahu event like version much more, right? Where they don't get this stutter and they don't get this, you know, or halting, and they're not flawed as a Navi and they are able to do their mission. And Moshe, he refuses so many times, right? Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, politely demure, like when somebody offers you a second slice of cake, right? You politely say no and then you have it, right? So Moshe, wouldn't it be a lot better if he just said no thank you and then said yes, right? Like Moshe says five times. Moshe's really serious about not wanting to be a Navi. I would say is, well, the lesson Moshe learns, and I think that Chazal really are trying to emphasize, which is that thing that Moshe always thought was his major flaw, the kvad peh kvad lashon, the thing that marked him as being inferior and being unable, really unable to do his job, Chazal are trying to say, like, he never realized that was actually his strength. That was what marked him from infancy as being special, as being saved by Hashem, as being someone who, even as a young child, everybody looked at him and saw his significance, right? The advisor saw it, Yitro saw it, Karo saw it, right? Moshe didn't see it, but everybody else saw it, and that marked him as something special. And his kvad peog fadlachon, his disability, which he thought was a disability, was what made him amazing and what made him special. And he always had the wrong view of how to look at his disability. I think it's a beautiful lesson for us about, you know, the weaknesses and insecurities we have in our lives, and that kind of makes us special. But for Chazal, they're trying to say, you could look at Moshe's disability as something negative, or you could look at it and say, that's, even as a young boy, what made him special and what made him great and full of potential. Yes?
It's very interesting in the two examples that you gave, and